Welcome back to Caracast, the podcast from Carasoft, the trusted government IT solutions provider. Subscribe to get the latest technology updates in the public sector. I'm Anthony Jimenez, your host from the Carasoft production team. On behalf of Carasoft and Fed Insider, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focused around innovating service delivery to constituents. Khalid Tafik, Director of IT and CIO for the City of San Jose, California, Scott Kahn, CIO for the City of Modesto, California, and Jake Sager, Senior Director of Platform Strategy for Granicus, will discuss how some states are rethinking service delivery to ensure that they can meet constituents' needs online with ubiquitous technologies.
We are just about to start. I'm Claudia Hosky from Fed Insider, and I would like to welcome you all to our event today, Vision 2024. Fed Insider and Carasoft started this event during the pandemic with the goal of reconnecting people who'd sort of lost connections, lost groups, lost that camaraderie during the pandemic, and to share essential communications about technology, specifically for state and local government, and to build trusted networks between IT experts. I'd like to thank our sponsors today, Fortinet, Granicus, and NinjaOne, and special thanks to our partner and CPE sponsor, Carasoft. I have a few house notes before we start. The Wi-Fi code is up there on the slides, but it's the Marriott Conference, and the password is Fed Insider. That's Fed Insider, capital I, no spaces. Restrooms are located just down the hall this way, right by the staircase. And on your table, you have a few items. We have an agenda for today, and we also have a CPE sheet. It's an evaluation. We want your feedback from today to help us improve future events. And if you're here for CPE credit, we need you to please fill out that little blue box there that says, yes, I want CPE credit. Give us your name and email. If you have a government email address or you have any trouble getting attachments, you may want to give us a Hotmail, Gmail, does anyone use Hotmail? A different email address so that we can get that certificate to you after today's event. And please turn it in at the registration desk before you leave today. Christy and Jen at the desk out there are holding your parking validations hostage, so please bring them an evaluation and they'll be happy to pay for your parking today. We are also using Slido.com to take questions from the audience in real time during today's discussions. You can scan the QR code or put that number into Slido.com. You don't have to register or anything. And you can submit your questions and participate in surveys during today's event. And lastly, we have our happy hour reception following today's discussion, so we hope you'll stick around. We have an awesome group of people, both on stage and in the audience today, so do make a point to meet someone new before you go. We have great minds here, and we're really excited about the discussions. So if you need anything at all, look for someone from our team or visit the registration desk. We're here to help you out with anything you may need today. And now please join me in welcoming our opening panel and our moderator, Jane Norris from Fed Insider.
Thank you, Claudia, and thank you to our Fed Insider team and all of our sponsors that are here today. We're very pleased to welcome you all, and I am thrilled to be in San Jose. What a beautiful city, my first time here, and I am just as happy as I can be to talk a lot about technology and especially artificial intelligence. We have an incredible panel, so let's just get right to it. I'll read a little introduction here so you know what the agenda is. But basically, the topic is innovating service delivery to constituents using advanced technologies. So governments on all levels are moving quickly to integrate new solutions and overhaul processes that need streamlining. At the same time, officials are keeping close watch on AI. You all know this better than anyone. And other emerging technologies, wary of the law of unintended consequences. For instance, in early September, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order directing state agencies to study the development, use, and risks of generative AI as a necessary precursor to AI governance. At the same time, states like California are rethinking how they interact and deliver services to their residents. The mass adoption of smartphones, which we're all sitting here with today, has led many constituents to use them to access government services. And this has led to web page redesigns and the simplification of widely used resources. It also places further emphasis on improved cybersecurity to protect visitors' privacy and security. That's what our group has joined us here to talk about today, so let's get started. First, I want to introduce, many of you probably know him, Khaled Tawfiq. Khaled is the Chief Information Officer from the City of San Jose. Nice to have you. Scott Kahn is CIO for Modesto, California. Scott, pleasure to have you here. And Jake Sager is Senior Director of Platform Strategy at Granicus. Hi, Jake. Wonderful. Thank you all for being here today. So let's start with a question for you, Khaled. How does the City of San Jose incorporate innovative technologies like AI to improve services for constituents? And how does AI change the way you do business in government?
As you can see, I'm technically challenged, but work on it. Or AI in my life. So really, the change we're going through today is really phenomenal. We know that AI is happening. We know that our business model has to change to meet what's happening in the industry. If you look at the last 30 years and what's changing, if you can combine the introduction to the internet, email, smartphones, social media, you name it, and wireless, if you can combine all of that together, this is really what we have today. The use of AI is going to make a difference between the business as versus the business government to just have two kids in college and how they use ChatGPT. I can only think about the professor who has to grade their paper or grade their assignment. She has no idea, he or she doesn't have an idea whether the kids are really read the book or spend 5 seconds on ChatGPT to give the answer. And that kind of made me think about, from our perspective, when we conduct interviews, are we dealing with answers from people or the ChatGPT, the answers before they came to the interview? And now the answers all of a sudden became brilliant. And now we have to peel a couple more layers to really understand whether they understand what they copied from ChatGPT or not. So from that perspective, everything that we're doing is gonna change. And the public's expectation of how we provide the service is also changing. So from that perspective, I think AI is gonna change how we perform, how we interact, and how we provide service. And that's really just the beginning of understanding what that means for us.
Incredible. And how do you identify what is generated by AI and what is authentic?
Because remember the old commercial or Memorex?
Right.
This is really where we are today. We have no idea whether it's a human deal we're dealing with from the other side, from the email, or it's actually a machine responding to us.
Well, I assume that's one of the things that your organizations are working on today, how to identify this AI and whatnot. So Scott, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about Modesto. So what are some of the recent or ongoing projects that showcase how Modesto is using AI to enhance online searches and device applications to improve service delivery?
One of the more interesting ones is the incorporation of a chatbot, an AI-driven chatbot called CityBot, into our website. Actually, not just our website, but our smart device app, Go Modesto, and our intranet. So where ChatGPT scans everything out in the outside world and gives you intelligent feedback, this particular bot is designed to scan your website. And if you're anything like Modesto's website, it's very hierarchical. Every department has a page because they want to brag about their department, and the residents don't care, right? I just want to go and get my business license. How do I do that? I just want to go pay my utility bill. How do I do that? OK, okay? Or I'm looking for this particular document that I know exists. How do I get a hold of that? Again, with everybody's website putting so much information, because we're government, we have to keep everything. Everything's a public record. Everything's a document. We have stuff from 30 years ago. How do I find that stuff? You just simply talk to this city bot, and it will go find it for you on our website. So it will drill down and mine everything we have, even from 20 years ago, find the document, and retrieve it for you. It's very slick, and it does it in 71 different languages. Okay? This is one of the great uses, easy uses, low-hanging fruit uses of artificial intelligence that we've got going today.
And so what technology are you using to drive that data retrieval?
Just an internal knowledge base on steroids is really what it is.
And how long has it been operating?
CityBot has been out there for over 5 years now, I believe.
What's your output? What do you think the outgrowth of that has been? Yeah. What are your metrics, improvements?
Well, it's right in the infancy stages. We're piloting it right now, so I don't have key performance indicator data to give you, but I can tell you that our city council loves this thing. They were one of our biggest detractors on the website. I can't find this information. Well, now the council member that has difficulty with technology can just say what he's looking for, and bang, it shows up, or takes him to the page where the information is located. So right now I'm gauging it in smiles and happiness of our city council.
That's important. All right, let's go to you, Jake. Discuss the journey that state and local agencies, because they're very different, right? Government comes at different levels, so state and local has unique challenges, right? So please talk about how they transform their constituent services, as you've been hearing, with new technologies and platforms, and the change management process, maybe the internal process that they have to put in place in order to get uptake on some of what they're trying to develop.
Shut up.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
It was on.
Yeah, you can pull it forward a little bit, too.
So I think one of the interesting things about some of the answers so far is when you look at technology, it can be incredibly impactful and incredibly powerful. But I think the other thing that we all need to make sure we keep in mind, it's not just about the technology. Things like AI can sometimes be only as good as the input in terms of what is actually searching and what is actually looking at. I think when we look at transformation, it's really the technology, the people, and processes that ultimately manage that technology. How some of those things are to manifest itself. Taking Bot, which I'm familiar with, it's an amazing company. Brat and the CEO over there is amazing. But when you look at, websites and content and services, oftentimes we see outdated calendar events or outdated, parades for the upcoming fireworks celebration. And so the content itself and the process and the people that are actually managing that must also stay in lockstep and modernize along with the technology that we're looking to deploy. And so again, when you look at that transformation, it's not just layering technology on top of existing people, existing processes. We need to continue to change our mindset to also adapt and move just as quickly as the technology as well, and ensure that we communicate across the organization so that we don't leave anyone behind in that journey.
So how does that communication process take place?
I think there's many different ways. I think, part of this, and I'll deep dive into this, I think, a little bit later potentially, but it's really putting, a first approach. And so part of this, individuals, like the council member that Scott was talking about, they may not want to do anything but the chat experience. Others may prefer text messages to keeping up to date. Others may prefer email or all of these different channels and different places that we need to be able to meet people where they are in terms of how we start to think about that communication strategy as well.
Is an omni-channel approach, I assume that's what the chatbot has. And so, is that absolutely necessary at this point? And I think if you just pull it closer, it will stay on.
All right. Yeah, if you're not thinking multi-channel, omni-channel, how to keep those consistencies across the different areas that you support your services and your constituents, I think you're already starting to fall behind. It's absolutely imperative in today's age with the explosion of content, the explosion of channels that we experience on a regular basis.
Thank you. Thank you all. That great answers. So let's talk about people and process improvements, right? Because without people and process improvements, you can have all the technology in the world and you're not going to get much of a result. So Khaled, I'll turn to you again. What changes or outcomes do you expect to see when you initiate a new technology or a new capability? What outcomes do you look for? How do you know that you're making progress? What lessons learned can you share with other organizations based on your experience of implementation?
Great question. I think the bottom line is the customer satisfaction. Everything that we do, we serve constituents. We're not a profit company. We cannot look at the stock price or market share. So the only thing we look at is how satisfied our customers are with what we provide. That's really the bottom line. Everything else is just a subproduct of what we do. What we do in San Jose, if you go to San Jose, ca.gov, we have a dashboard for 311, and 311 services within the IT organization. And everything that comes through 311, whether it's parking violation, homeless encampments, potholes, graffiti, whatever service we provide 311, we have a dashboard, and at the end of every ticket, we send a survey and we capture the results for that. So regardless of what internal performance indicators we track, the bottom line, we can track it all day or all night, but if the customer surveys are not improving, then we're missing the mark. So that's really the key indicator. And council loves it because we're transparent. We're not hiding our problems, because if we don't know our problems, we're not going to solve it. And two, making sure that the internal operations, because it's seldom that we deal with an issue in government that requires one section of our department to deal with it. Usually multiple department, multiple services. So making sure that when we adopt or we incorporate a new process or a service, that's being addressed from a holistic view. Otherwise, we can improve the internal indicator for that section or that department, but the final product or the final customer survey will not reflect the improvement. So these are the two things. How can we get everybody to get out of the silo to look at how is my role going to impact other departments so we can serve our constituent in the best possible way? And how can I get out of my comfort zone to adopt to the new technology, new process, to make sure that everybody's on the same page for that process?
Okay, makes a lot of sense. But and here's a question from the audience I think will fit into your answer. What are the biggest challenges that you face, agencies face, when it comes to modernizing technology? Is it money? Is it, you know, getting people on board? Is it the new processes, the constant iteration? What's the biggest thing for you?
I have to say it's the delay or the gap between when we decide to do something and when the resources are available to get it done. Because we budget 1 year in advance. So if I want to solve problem X, I have to request it almost a year in advance and fight for the money and get the budget. So if by the time I get the budget, what if problem X is no longer the issue? Maybe now problem Y is a bigger one. I don't have the flexibility to say, just switch and go. Or I might be asking for, even when we do our fees and things like that, we have some strict restrictive rules to allow to number one, to make sure that we're not wasting taxpayers' money, and to make sure that there's no abuse and all that great stuff, I agree. But at the same time, it kind of hinders our ability to pivot based on what we're seeing from the constituents and what we're seeing from the industry. I was at a dinner meeting a couple weeks ago, and the discussion in the private sector, everybody's concerned about the development with the AI platforms. Because every 6 months, there is a new platform, new technology being released. And the concern is, if we put all our development in one area and that technology, the baseline changes, then all our investment in that location or that platform is wasted. We have the problem is even bigger because we have a year and a half of study planning. And so trying to really find a way to work within the guidelines and to be able to pivot to address the immediate need or the immediate change in the industry, that's probably one of the most challenging things. In addition to the legacy, you know, user acceptance and change management, all this stuff, these are, you know, inherited by everything. But I think just in government, the challenge is how can we find a way to pivot as quickly as we can, knowing the all the guidelines and restrictions that we have in government.
You have a comment?
Yeah, can I jump?
Similar to what Khaled is mentioning about the process, we were having this conversation at a table over here before we started the panel today. A lot of times the IT organization knows there's a really neat, innovative thing that we can do that would solve that problem, but depending upon where the executive management of the city or the agency that you're a part of is thinking, sometimes IT doesn't have a strategic seat at the table. IT is considered more of a, let's just keep the lights on, keep my email coming, and I'm good to go. As opposed to, hey, how would you improve this process? How would you do this different? And if you could do that, what do you need to make it happen? So it is a lengthy process in government to get things like that approved. But I would say one of the most important things is make sure you've got a seat at the table so you can show them, hey, we can be innovative. We're not just here to keep the lights on or your email coming. We have ideas. Give us some money to get it going for you.
Jake.
Yeah, I was just going to plus one some of what these gentlemen are saying as well, because I think it's also the importance of pivoting, that the specific word that Khaled used. It's also changing the mindset. I often see in my experience this idea of a project. We have to start and just execute the project. But transformation is not this start date, end date, this finite path. It's how do you maintain the flexibility? How do you think of it like a product or a program so that it can continue to live and breathe and evolve so that you can pivot? And part of that is how can you just simply get started? If you know that long-term journey where you ultimately want to go, you know technology is going to change inherently in that time frame. So why not start with an alpha, then a beta, and then ultimately start to get this rolling thunder as you start to pivot and adapt and change the priorities if needed, and that's okay.
That's okay. That's the part that people, I think, have to get used to. That's okay. It's okay to fail, right? In some cases, not completely fail, but learn from your experience and move on.
Yeah, if you're going to fail, fail fast and learn from it.
After this, I don't think any government agency that has ChatGPT or AI budget in their current budget here, right? How many of you have anything related to ChatGPT or AI in your budget? Zero. So the question is, and we're doing a lot with ChatGPT and AI. So the question is, how can we be flexible enough? So when we ask even for our budget, how can we have some flexibility and how can we have some flexibility with our vendors to have some way of getting what we need done without breaking the rules and regulations? So that's really the art of doing the impossible in government. But,
Those of you who haven't done so, you can scan that QR code and ask a question if you'd like to. We'd be happy to take a look at those. And Scott, I want to go back to you. You have moved forward with a public Wi-Fi, which is pretty groundbreaking, I think, for people. How have you achieved this? And you know, what challenges or issues did you face?
Sure. Public Wi-Fi was a concept put forth, at least in Modesto, by our council pre-COVID. Said, why don't we line all of our downtown streets with private or public Wi-Fi that anybody could just get on? No passwords, no protections, no nothing. Of course, this is why I don't have as much hair as I used to. And it came down to sitting with each and every council member and explaining to them, okay, if we turn the Wi-Fi on forever in downtown, two things are going to happen. First thing is you have a lot of businesses that actually attract customers. Think of your local Starbucks to come in, have some coffee, open up their laptop, and get some work done. Okay, now you're competing with them, bringing customers into their shop downtown. Number two, you're going to have people that are not as fortunate as others, so they're going to be parking their cars, sleeping in them at night, and checking their devices overnight, and you'll start to see some encampments come up, and you're just going to be, bees to a honey trap with folks in your downtown area. Is that what you really want? Once they understood the ramifications of that, we were able to put limitations on the Wi-Fi. So it only operates during certain hours. Typically, it's daylight. Or if we know there's a special occasion in the evening, let's say it's a Festival of Lights parade, we can keep it on. But we typically will shut it down. So that takes care of people camping out, if you will. Okay. The other piece is we put in, or in the process of putting, public Wi-Fi in each city facility, so that when a resident comes to do business with the city or comes to participate in a city activity, they have access to things. So it can be at the soccer fields. It could be at the softball field. It could be at the utilities district where they want to sign up for water. Okay, so we're trying to make it as convenient as possible to do things and get information quickly, whether they're in a city facility or whether they're downtown. Okay, just not at 10 at night, right? So you have to put some limitations on there. And those of you who know how to do this, you have to put lease restrictions on how long somebody can be sitting there logged in. You know, you don't want them running their business, or you don't want somebody renting a building and running their business on your public Wi-Fi, right? So you put, yeah, you can be on for an hour and then we kick you out, that kind of thing.
About the privacy and the security that was involved in a public Wi-Fi, did you have conversations about that, and how did you resolve it?
We tried to figure out ways where maybe we could use this circuit as a backup internet circuit for the city, and we finally came to the conclusion we just had to isolate the thing. Don't let it touch anything city or agency-wise. It has to be its own thing. And we really did not go with a password either. We let it be the Wild West, and so far, knock on wood, we have not had any problems with that. So it's similar to going to your local airport. You can get on public Wi-Fi there, right? But we opened it up, but we just kept it completely isolated from anything else that the city touches.
And do you monitor? I mean, is there any output that you get from that?
Yeah, we actually have a third party managing that Wi-Fi network for us. It uses statistics, how many people logged in, how many people spent an hour or less on the system. When are the heavy traffic times, therefore you're going to get slower internet speeds, etc. But we track all that. But rather than have city staff take care of this, we basically farmed it out to a vendor, and they manage it and take care of it.
And I guess the response has been pretty overwhelmingly positive?
Oh, very positive. Yeah. Very positive.
That's wonderful.
I mean, it's funny going to a city council meeting and seeing everybody in the chambers not paying attention to anybody at the dais. They're just looking at their phones.
It's probably not one. That's one of the unintended consequences. All right, let's go to you, Jake, and talk about the impact of human-centered design. A lot of what we're discussing today all started with an ideation session. I know a lot of you are probably familiar with human-centered design. Talk about that process and how easy or difficult it is for clients that you might deal with to initiate that and get other people on board based on how that process goes.
Great question, Jane. Of human-centered design, I mean, for those of you maybe not as familiar, in short, it's putting people first, not thinking about the government, how are they structured, what's my budget today. It's really sitting down, letting them understand what are the true things that they need and how are they organically, naturally going to interact with them as well. One of the stories that I always like to talk through with this piece is, we see individuals, they want this brand new, beautiful kiosk in downtown. But then we say, okay, well, are people actually going to use it? Rather than investing thousands of dollars into this kiosk, why can't you just simply test it first, put a giant refrigerator box on the counter or on the curb and draw the icons and different things, stand by there and start asking people, hey, would you actually use this? And if they do, great, then you continue to iterate, you continue to evolve and test other locations, but you start to validate the idea of a kiosk is actually potentially valuable and important. Another common example, you see this, you know, it's very, very common on like college campuses, but you see it in parks and things today as well. Before you go build the rectangular sidewalk around the rectangular park, actually sit and watch people, where do they naturally walk through the paths across the park? After they do that, then go put in the pavement, then go put in, you know, the brick stone thereafter so you can save costs. It's naturally going to be better because if you put in that placement anyways, they're just going to cut the corner and it's just a complete waste at that point in time. And so really the idea of human-centered design, putting people first, learning quick, learning fast, back to that idea of pivoting that we've been talking about and staying agile, has a tremendous impact in terms of how we can continue to evolve and iterate on service delivery.
And if you wanted to gather information about people's pain points, how would you go about doing that? Say you have something like the Wi-Fi system that he's talking about that Scott has put in place. How do you find out what it is they want or need?
It goes back to the earlier conversation of omni-channel communications, multi-channel, because if you just simply stand on one single corner, you're not going to reach everybody who may potentially be impacted by the thing you're working on. And so how can you meet people where they are and actually have that communication strategy up front so that you can reach people on social, on email, on SMS, on your website, via the chatbot, wherever it might be, to help prompt people so that they have that initial awareness in the first place to understand, yes, I can voice my opinion, I can give my feedback so that government agencies can actually start to collect that data, interpret the data. I love what Khaled's doing with this 311 that he was talking about. It doesn't have to be, you know, super complex. You've submitted a pothole request, you know, tell us a little bit more information. It can be these micro engagements. It doesn't have to be this annual 100 question long survey that is so common as well.
Did you want to comment on that?
True. Sure. It's the small things that make a big difference. We had abandoned vehicles, the customer surveys back in April of last year, May of last year. We had 14% customer satisfaction. Yeah, 14% of the customers felt good about that service. And of course, when we don't provide the service, guess who do they call? The mayor and council. And guess who the mayor and council will be calling? They call me and say, what's happening? And is it the system? Is it this? And so we started looking into how we can change the process of responding. And one of the things we discussed, why do people really like Amazon? If you think about it, it's a continuous feed of the information that you're getting. Maybe the product is not the best because they don't make their, for the most part, Amazon don't make their own product, but deliver it in every step of the way. I can check, is it on the truck? Is it in being delivered? Here's a picture of what I have. And we said, we cannot really address the issues with abandoned vehicles because we have, you know, lived in vehicles, we have homeless issues, and it's almost impossible to deal with it, right? But at least if we can give them some piece of communication to let them know we're trying to do something, explain to them. That was probably one of the biggest things that we did, constant communication, and we changed the language in the email from saying, by law, we cannot do anything about this, to we're making every effort, we understand the frustration and empathize with the customer. All of a sudden, we went from 14%, the latest survey we were getting, the average is now about 43%. So it's more than 100% improvement, 100% improvement in 1 year. It's unheard of, especially in government. But it wasn't like a big system that, although we're making huge improvement to the 311 system from the back end, but we haven't launched it yet. It's coming in March of next year. But the small changes that we made throughout the way, these are the small things that really made a big difference and also allowed us to do two things. One, we tried minor enhancements, and then when we realized that it didn't really make a big difference to customer satisfaction, then we stopped. This is not something that they care about. If we change the language in the email and the communication and surveys went in the negative direction, it's like, okay, we're wasting our time with the communication. Let's focus on something else. It really allowed us to make small investment in time and money and see where the investment can pay off the most. And to my surprise, communication, not surprising, but it was really the biggest impact on us, on the customer satisfaction, when we communicated more frequently, more clearly, and the language was more empathetic versus like, you know, by law, we cannot do anything about this, or the vehicle did not meet the, 1628 procedure or laws, whatever. Just changing the minor things made a huge difference with us.
And I love that. I really do. I think communication is definitely the key to making changes. Do you have any comments, Scott?
It's just the concept of continuous evolvement, continuous improvement. You know, just keep doing that circle and get better every time. And a lot of people like to draw it like I did with my finger here. It should be an upward spiral is what it should be. Constantly improving, going higher.
Love it. So let's move on. And Khaled, I want to ask you, you have many hats that you wear. You're the co-chair of the Government AI Coalition, or GovAI, a network of 100 government agencies across the country that are collaborating to create standards for responsible AI. So what benefits does that collaboration bring, and what are the next steps for the coalition?
Thank you. It's kind of interesting. When we released the guidelines for generative AI a few months back, we put it on the web, and we didn't really do a press release or anything like that, but all of a sudden we got bombarded from phone calls from cities, mayors within the Bay Area and nationwide. And most of the questions that I got, what you guys are doing, what kind of projects San Jose is doing so we can use your AI project to duplicate in the city, in our cities. And our approach was completely different. Number one, AI is going to happen whether we like it or not. I don't think we're going to be talking about AI in a couple of years from now. I don't think anybody brags about having email or a website anymore, right? Because it's embedded in everything that we do. 20 years ago, people said, do you web? Do you email? Right? It was a thing 20 years ago, but it's given if you're alive and have pulse, you're using email and use the web. So AI is going to be embedded where it's not going to be a thing anymore. So whether we do it or not, it's going to happen. So the question is, are we going to learn from the past to do something about it or not? When we launched our internets and we made it the Wild West, we paid the price with cybersecurity because we did not think about the consequences of opening the internet to everyone. None of us will send our children and give them a bike and say, go figure it out. But we did that with social media. Here's a phone, go figure it out, because we have no experience with it. Right. The same thing with social media, the same thing with every almost technology. We jumped in the pool without even knowing the basics of swimming. And that's why we have so many problems with abuse on social media, with cybersecurity and everything else. So we, learning from our mistakes in the last 20, 30 years, we said, this is a golden opportunity for us to try to be proactive, try to learn from the mistakes that we made over the years and say, what could go wrong? How can we find out? And what are we going to do about it to mitigate that risk? So this is how we started to think about it, that our policy, our education, our analysis has to be from the perspective, it's happening whether we like it or not. I will not be able to stop my employees, my staff from using it. The public is using it, therefore they're expecting us to use it. Then how can we frame it so, number one, we utilize it in a responsible way, and we use it, you know, and utilize it in an effective way. So started the conversation with a couple of CIOs, and then all of a sudden everybody is really excited because everybody's challenged. Like I said, none of us put this in our budget. Just happened to be fortunate that we have a program within the city that we started to invest in digital privacy and digital equity. And I had a team that had been doing a methodical way of developing policies, developing a platform for that. So when AI became a thing and everybody's asking, we need to do that, we started applying the same model that we have for privacy and equity. And we said, okay, we need to look at the privacy and equity and security related to AI. So it was a natural progression for us. Not because we're geniuses or anything like that. We just happened to have a program that we were able to pivot in the right direction. And in conversation with other CIOs, they said, well, we have no resources. We don't have, you know, enough to keep up what we have today. So we said, why don't we divide and conquer? Instead of San Jose or San Francisco or any agency try to do everything, why don't we define what we need to do? And we're going to have a coalition of teams, of cities, and divide and conquer. Each one of us will take one, build it, bring it back to the committee, get the coalition to approve it, and we make a commitment that we will invest, copy, provide feedback, and invest, give back to the coalition. And within a couple of months, we have more than 100 agencies already joined. And actually, as we speak, we're meeting the second meeting for the coalition. We meet once a month with the general meeting. Please don't tell them I'm here, otherwise they'll be upset that I wasn't attend. But it's really that the second the teams coming together or the cities coming together, and each one of the cities picked one item. Two, we don't have a voice with the vendors. I cannot tell Google or Microsoft, I don't like how he deal with privacy. I don't like how he dealing with whatever, right? But collectively, if we put the same language in our procurement, then they don't have a chance but to say, okay, if I'm going to deal with cities, we have 100 cities participating in this coalition, and all of them want to know how Google is going to use our data or how Granicus will be using our stuff. So no matter. But if we all of us agree that this is important to us, right? There's no chance for them to ignore us anymore. And I'm going to share one example with you. We developed our first 311 app like almost 11 years ago when I was with LA County, and Apple had a very strict rule with the Apple Store. They wanted to sign, you cannot change anything in the agreement. Of course, LA County said, well, LA County, they have to change. We don't like this language. We don't need this. We don't need it out. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. So, of course, you won't. We're LA County. Apple prevailed. They said, take it or leave it. So as big as LA County, they had to, look the other way. So, okay, fine. We'll accept the agreement as is. And they, we went with it. But if we have 100 agencies and hopefully we'll become 200 or 300 that participate and we all agree that For any vendor to sell us an AI system, they have to disclose how they collect the data, where they get the information, how do they train, what kind of equity issues did they addressing, what kind of privacy issue they can demonstrate for us, and now we have a voice, because today we don't, especially in this area. Second thing, why do we need to do the same thing over and over? Instead of each one of us developing our own guidelines and our own policies, we develop it once collectively and copy and paste. Just put your logo on it, make a couple changes that might be, important to you only for your city and make it your own. Three, instead of evaluating vendors, AI vendors, and doing pilot white papers for each one, we do it once. All of us come together, evaluate vendors, and publish a matrix to say, this is where they are good at, this is where they're not good at. And hopefully we have one procurement. So we do it once and everybody get to access that procurement for their benefit. So these are some of the things, and that's why I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised that in less than 2 months, we have more than 100 agencies signed up because they started to see the value and they started to feel like, great, we use it, we get feedback, it gets better, we copy it, and everybody benefits. So that's really where we're going with it, and it's picking up a lot of momentum. I'm very proud of the founding cities that joined us and the new ones that want to take the lead in, they have expertise in certain areas or resources that specialize in one or more areas, and they want to participate. So I'm looking forward really to see where we're going in next year with that one.
It's really exciting. We'll definitely follow the progress on that. And thank you for sharing that information. Anybody that wants to become part of the coalition, you can always talk to Khaled.
Search GovAI San Jose.
Sign me up.
All right. I'm surprised you haven't already, Scott.
So, Scott, I wanted to check with you, and I also want to include in the question that I'm going to ask you, you have some virtual receptionist kiosks at city facilities where a resident walks up, touches the screen, selects an area or a topic, and then a live person comes on. That's pretty unique. So tell us about that. And also, if you wouldn't mind, talk to us about the risks and the rewards that you thought about when you put these kiosks in place.
Certainly. Before I do that, just a general question about AI, period. I downloaded San Jose's guidelines for usage. Fantastic. I mean, that really was useful. Compliment you on
that.
Cool. The other thing is, raise your hand if you have seen companies that are 20 and 30 years old now claiming that they've been using AI that entire time, right? Joe Bob's truck stop, when the little thing tells you how much gas you've pumped, hey, that's AI.
It's AI.
Okay, we've been doing this for years. So the virtual receptionist idea kind of came to us at the end of COVID. We had residents that come to our City Hall building. We're on six different floors. Depending upon what department you want to talk to, you go to those floors and there's a counter that greets you. We've been having to staff people at the counters to take care of the public. And frequently they would get asked a question and they'd say, okay, give me a minute. And they'd go back and find somebody who knew the answer, or they'd find the papers that people were asking about and bring them out to the resident. And we just said, the resident's up there coughing on them, and, you know, staff is getting, you know, further and further away from the counter. And it just, the personal experience wasn't working at the tail end of COVID. So we decided we'd partner with Zoom. And we came up with a monitor, and it's a touchscreen monitor, and it basically gives them choices. What do you hear? What do you need to do today? What do you want to do today? I want to pay my utility bill. So they touch a button, and it will actually initiate a Zoom call to the person in the back sitting at their office or in their cubicle, and they will answer, and it's a interactive one-on-one conversation with the individual. And if the individual has the information at hand, they can pull it up on the screen, just like you share screens in Teams or Zoom meetings, and show them, oh, here's what you're talking about, here's what you need to do, here's the information you wanted, is that good? Did we take care of you today? If they don't have the information, they can actually say, give me a second, I'm going to find the person who has that data, and they'll actually add them to the screen, to the call. Okay, and if now that I've added Khaled and I know he has the answer, I can drop off. I just transfer the meeting to Khaled. And so now one-on-one, and it's a great interaction. The public feels safer because they're not having a city staffer breathe on them. And the city staffer feels safer too. They also have become more productive. They're not having to stay at the counter waiting for somebody to show up, right? So when a person comes in, there's good signage, touch the screen, touch the button that makes the most sense to you, and we'll take care of you. And the residents have loved the experience. So we started out in the utilities department first, and now every department. Yeah, when do I get my kiosk? When can my people now get some work done in their cube or their office, as opposed to standing at the counter waiting for somebody? So it's been tremendously successful. So it's starting to spread.
Are there any risks involved? I mean, that sounds like a fairly risk-free capability.
The only risk, no, that's not the only, a couple of risks. The first risk was, suppose they touch the button and nobody picks up the call. Okay, what do we do then? Well, we basically put it just like your regular telephone system on a hunt group. So if it doesn't get person A, it goes to person B, it goes to person C, it goes to person D. Somebody's going to pick up. And the department heads are monitoring whether people are answering the calls or not answering the calls. That was number one. Number two was, can the technology sustain a positive and real-time conversation? Or is it going to be, you know, start, stop, catch every other word? So we had to make sure we had enough bandwidth going and prioritize it from a quality control perspective, that traffic took precedent over other traffic, right? So to this day, it's just been glass smooth, perfect. It's been fun.
Scott, I'm curious. I know your staff probably turned the cameras on. How about the public? Do you see a lot of people turning their cameras when they talk to your staff or city staff?
They turn their
cameras? For the Zoom.
Oh, the cameras are built into the monitor.
Oh, so okay. They're only from the camera.
Yeah, so actually the cameras are pretty superior in the monitor too. It's a company called D10. Okay, so it's a nice sized monitor. I mean, it's a good 27 inch to 35 inch monitor, and it has three different cameras. So if all three of us walked up to the monitor, it would actually Hollywood squares us. It would put us into three different boxes on the person who's answering the call and answering the question. So it's pretty slick.
These are great capabilities, so thanks very much.
On the other thing, and I'm not here to promote Zoom. I don't own stock in Zoom, but they're actually working with us to do real-time translation as well, where somebody may speak Spanish to us, and our rep will see English on their screen, and vice versa. So they're looking at how they could do that.
Well, Excellent. Jake, I want to ask you, communications, I think we've been talking pretty thoroughly about the many aspects of communications that are needed to explain systems, to get people on board, to bring them up to speed. How do you put those kinds of plans in place if clients aren't used to sending out detailed communications to sort of change the game, if you will?
Yeah, I think communications oftentimes is one of the, I'll say the attributes that are commonly missed or left out in terms of change management and applying new technology, introducing some of these things. It's a bit like the old proverb of a tree falls in a forest, did it make a sound? Well, you don't really know because nobody knows about it or they're not there. And so part of it is how can you actually understand that full customer journey is a first step, a first part of that. Because if you can truly understand from the initial awareness stage before somebody, say, interacts with a service, all the way through the process of they've experienced the service, they've responded or submitted a pothole, if we use that example, to the follow-up of the pothole's been filled thereafter, and maybe even down the line, you can still check in on things like customer satisfaction. So understanding that entire customer journey allows you to see and better distill and start to analyze what are those different touch points where a potential opportunity to communicate can actually be woven into that. Because again, oftentimes we see this amazing submission process, it goes through a workflow, public works may go out to fill the pothole, and then nobody actually knows, was it fulfilled, or did they go to a different street, or why has it not happened yet because we're actually prioritizing something else, or the emergency center was turned on, so we can't get to it. And so the importance of having that communication and aligning back to, again, the omni-channel, multi-channel approach, people need to feel respected about their preferred channels and their channels of choice, and being able effectively across all of those different channels is really, again, step one. But then we need to be able to remember those specific channels as well, because oftentimes people have preferences. And so if we see a trend in people communicating through one way, we want to be able to adapt and remember that as well. And then again, kind of that third piece, being able to feel responded to. So if I've submitted that pothole, again, just to kind of keep that analogy going, I want to be able to understand, why is this delayed? Was it actually fulfilled? And if it, I may have actually applied for a service, help me understand or remind me in some cases that I need to actually go finish or do something. Oftentimes in government services, there's a bit of back and forth, or somebody maybe misfiled a specific application. And so again, weaving in communications throughout that process at every touch point is incredibly important to be able to have that increased sense of trust and awareness about the services that we're ultimately delivering.
Music to my ears, having been a communicator for many years. So that's really wonderful information. All right, so this next section is going to be a little bit of a lightning round since we're about 5 minutes to the end of the hour. So I could talk to you guys all day, but I will start with you, Khalid. It's a great deal of discussion about the ethical use of AI. And one of the questions that came in is, how do we know that AI is going to take over the world, right? That robots are going to be running things and people will be obsolete. So my question for you is, how do you ensure the ethical and responsible use of AI tools by city and staff and other people that you work with in your day-to-day?
So we don't know what we don't know, and we cannot control the masses. If anyone that has kids understand that I cannot control what the kids will do. The only thing I can do is provide them with a channel or a platform where they feel safe and comfortable to share what they know with me. That way I can intervene when I feel they're really in trouble. So when ChatGPT became, a consumer product, a lot of CIOs felt that this is too high of a risk, and they attempted to block the links or from the firewall, trying to prevent people from going. I don't know how they can do that, but if a parent feels good about doing things with the firewall that they think they're circumventing their kids, good luck with that. So we took a completely different approach. We said, we do want people to use it, But you can use ChatGPT under two conditions. One, you register with IT, just let us know that you're using it. And two, tell us how you're using it. Just give me feedback. That's all I'm asking, right? And some of them, you know, tested us and they you know, registered and just to see if two people are going to show up with badges and escort them out of the building, or we were okay with it. And we said, okay, that's exactly what we want, because we're not using ChatGPT. We don't know how ChatGPT is being used in the city. And the first thing for us to uncover something is to know about it. So that was number one. Two, we established four working groups. We said for people to use ChatGPT, we think it's going to be one about classification. So we had one with HR. If you're developing classification or developing, not classification, I'm sorry, a job posting, and you're going to use ChatGPT, let the HR lead that conversation with the users. With IT, so we at least we can learn from both, kind of guide the conversation and learn through the process. Two, council meetings and council memos. You know, we know people are using it. Great, use it. Just make sure that when you send the information to ChatGPT, don't send information that can be public before you send it to council, because now you're given the public information before your council can meet about it. That will put us in a tough position. So that was the second education. The third one, we looked at permitting. If somebody wants to do certain things in general in AI, what do we need to do to do that? So we kept adding more and more, but the conversation is, let us know, teach us how you're using it and what kind of issues you're seeing so we can learn and help you defend it. But this has really been the challenge for us to, number one, keep the trust, keep the faith in the new system, and work as a team versus we're trying to prevent somebody from doing something.
And Scott, did you want to comment?
Actually, one of the challenges we've identified, Khaled hit it on the head, is what do you share with ChatGPT from your agency?
Because once it's in ChatGPT, it becomes essentially public information.
Once it's there, it's in the wild, right? And they can use it, and anybody can use it to generate, you know, additional answers for you. But there are documents we have, 300-page PDFs, and you say, "Hey, summarize this for me." Well, the second they do that, that 300-page PDF is now in the wild. So we're actually starting to investigate some firms that have built something that's a workflow approval. Can you share this? If you know it's a potentially sensitive document, can you share this with ChatGPT or any of the other AI engines that are out there in the wild? And it basically is an approval process. I'm not trying to put the lawyers in charge, okay? It doesn't have to be them necessarily making the decision, but at least the department head should be able to say, no, that's something we don't want to share with ChatGPT. So it's not approved. Don't do that.
All right. So how many aspects of the use of ChatGPT do they need to check? Or is it just certain things that are going to be public facing?
As Khaled pointed out, we don't know what we don't know.
There you go.
I mean, I went in thinking I was really intelligent and talked to our city manager and said, "Hey, there's this ChatGPT thing. Have you ever seen it?" And he goes, "Yeah, it was cool. I had this email. I didn't know how to answer it. So I put it in there and it wrote an answer for me and it was really great." And I'm going, "Oh my God, what else is he doing?" I said, "What else have you done with this?" "Well, we wrote a speech for the mayor. It was pretty good too." You know, so these are the things we're trying to get our arms around and put in check and make sure we're not doing the wrong things, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's even a lesson that I've had to learn recently, right? You put it in there and it goes wherever it wants. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. Jake, I think you're going to get the final word here. How can state and local governments effectively evaluate the effectiveness of some of these creative endeavors that we're putting out there online? How do they know they've really hit the spot?
I mean, in short, given time, you have to start collecting the data. I mean, to Khaled's point earlier, just a little bit of data and information can have so much profound impact by simply understanding that was, I think, 14%, you had said, of one of the services, you know, to have that 100% increase. You don't know what you don't know. And if you don't know what your benchmark is today and how you can start to evaluate to know where to improve or how much you need to improve, then you're already, again, falling behind. And so master that data. It can be micro data collection points, but you have to start understanding that data.
And using it effectively. Well, I can't thank you enough.
Khaled, Jake, Scott, for the time that you spent with us today. Incredible conversation. I enjoyed it so much, and I know our audience did too. Thank you for your participation. And please stick around, ladies and gentlemen. We have another panel, and a lot of it will deal with AI, assessing the impact of AI with some wonderful experts. So we hope you'll stay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to our guests, Khaled Tafik, Scott Kahn, and Jake Sager. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to Caracast, and be sure to listen to our other discussions. If you'd like more information on how Carahsoft can assist your organization, please visit www.carahsoft.com or email us at slgmarketing@carahsoft.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.